after Aristotle. I began to introduce this period last time. Scholars call it the Hellenistic period. That's just a word for the ancient Greek world in the time of the consolidation of the empire from Alexander the Great. In philosophy, it means the period after Aristotle, but before the rise of the Roman Empire. And I told you that in this time, one of the characteristics of philosophy in this time is a proliferation of philosophical schools. Plato wasn't just Plato, he had a school where he taught, where there was a series of Platonists who came after him, masters who continued to teach. Aristotle had the same thing, and there were many other schools. Epicurus, the one that we're talking about now, is one of these Hellenistic schools of philosophy. Epicurus lived about a generation after Aristotle. He wasn't native to Athens, but he came to Athens shortly after Aristotle died, and he established his school, which was called the Garden, because he taught in the walled garden in his house in Athens. To take up the life of an Epicurean, I mean, you couldn't just go and sit and listen to his lectures anonymously and then at the end of the hour wander out. You had to get permission to come in and be part of this school. And if you got permission, you were expected to come there and be part of the group, to live there, to take meals there, to talk with the people there, to learn, to embrace the whole way of life that they offer, not just the philosophical discourse, the theories that the teachers teach. To take up the life of an Epicurean philosopher, you had to renounce wealth. Doesn't mean you had to give it away. You just had to agree to quit being preoccupied with it for the time that you're trying to study, so that you're not constantly, your mind isn't always on business, you're trying to do some deal. So you renounce the pursuit of wealth, you agree to give up politics, at least for the time that you're involved with the school, not being preoccupied with your public position. You agree to eat and dress in a simple way, and to live in retreat at the school and together with the students and other teachers. In these philosophical schools, the Epicurus and all the others, the other members, the older students, the associated teachers, they're all there to encourage and assist in the conversion to the philosophical way of life. People there take their meals together, they discuss together, they live together. They usually don't sleep together. That's the origin of the expression platonic love. I say a conversion to a philosophical life. I don't mean a religious conversion. I don't mean anything like initiation into a secret society. No one has more respect for rationality than these philosophers. Their theoretical flights are dedicated to giving reasons for their chosen way of life, and they're happy to explain those reasons to anyone. But philosophy requires a conversion of a different sort. The source of unhappiness, this is the philosophical analysis, the source of unhappiness is a disharmony between the soul and the universe. We can't change the universe, but we can change ourselves, our souls. We just need direction, which is what the philosophers offer. Epicurus conceives of philosophy on a medical model. It's a kind of therapy. The theory that Epicurean philosophy teaches is not supposed to be precious for its own sake as a precious truth. For Epicurus, the value of philosophy is philosophical understanding, is the value of that is curative. It helps you to become lastingly happy. One of the readings that we have is called the Letter to Menoesius. What would happen is that people would come to this school of Epicurus and maybe stay there for any period, months, years, and then perhaps their life concerns require that they leave, they go away to another province or whatever. So often Epicurus would write letters to these former students who were now abroad. And these letters would be summaries of the teachings, so they could continue to meditate and remember what the teaching was. And some of these have survived the millennia since the time of Epicurus, and there are sources of philosophy now. That's what the Letter to Menoesius is. Epicurus writing a letter summarizing his teaching to a former student, Menoesius. In that letter, he says, at the very beginning to Menoesius, he says, don't delay the decision to begin to study philosophy. You're never too young. You're never too old. It's never too soon. It's never too late to be concerned about the good of your soul. To say that the time is not yet right, that you're too busy, too many concerns, you're too young. To say that the time is not yet right to study philosophy is like saying the time is not yet right to become happy. The philosophy of Epicurus promises direction for overcoming the obstacles to happiness. Epicurus identifies those obstacles as fear, ignorance, and harmful beliefs and desires. If you could just eliminate those, which his philosophy promises to do, then happiness falls into your lap like a ripe fruit. In one way, Epicurus is a follower of Socrates. We suffer and behave badly because of ignorance. All the causes of unhappiness trace back to false beliefs, especially false beliefs about the gods, or about death, or about what is truly good in life. Happiness for Epicurus, as for Socrates, is a problem of knowledge. When philosophical knowledge replaces everyday opinion, we attain tranquility. We vanquish fear with superior understanding, just like Socrates vanquished the fear of death by those rational proofs of immortality that he rehearsed with his disciples the last day of his life in the Phaedon. So that much of Epicurus, just like Socrates. Except Epicurus doesn't follow the Pythagorean path that Socrates and Plato did. Epicurus denounces the idea of an immortal soul. And then he goes on to demonstrate in an entirely new and different way that death is nothing to fear. Nature, the way Epicurus thinks of it, is entirely different from Plato's vision of those ideas. For Epicurus, this world of ours is simply one of an infinity of worlds. Innumerable worlds scattered throughout an infinite void. That these worlds are constantly being generated and then destroyed by the ceaseless motion of atoms. Fundamental microscopic entities that are flowing through this infinite void. There's nothing ideal about our world. That's the materialism, the core of Epicurus' philosophy. Nothing ideal about our world, nothing spiritual, that is, immaterial, in nature. The forms of nature are one and all the mechanical result of survival and adaptation to the conditions of existence. Ignorance and misunderstanding lie at the root of all our mental disturbances, everything that disturbs our tranquility. Fear is just a response to things we don't understand. But this atomistic, mechanical world that Epicurus will be explaining to us, it's readily and reliably knowable. You can know it. It's just a big machine. And with that knowledge comes the key to lasting happiness. It's just the way Socrates promised, except on completely different principles, materialist principles that would have appalled Plato. Well, the very first thing that Epicurus thinks we need to do if we're not going to be frustrated in our pursuit of happiness is to have the right idea about the gods. We need to understand three things, my first three points here, about the gods. First, gods definitely exist. Epicurus is not an atheist. They exist, but they're also unconcerned with human affairs. Don't take any interest in whatever's going on down on Earth among the humans. And thirdly, these gods are nothing to fear. In fact, they're a model for our understanding what it is to be happy, even if you're a human being. Well, about that first point, you might wonder, how does he know that gods exist? For him, universal belief is a sufficient proof. People differ in how they particularly think of the gods, the particular stories that they might tell of gods, but at least as far as Epicurus knew, no matter where you go in the world, not just in Greece, but even among the barbarians, everybody believes in gods. And back of those, all those differences, there's that stock of belief, which Epicurus then says must just be natural. It's just a product of spontaneous nature that we believe in such things, and so he accepts that belief as true. What about the other point, the supposed indifference of the gods to anything that concerns human beings? How does he know that? He gives the three arguments that I've mentioned in the latter part of my overhead here. This is on the Avenue page also. The first argument for their indifference is that according to universal belief, these gods are immortal and blessed. That's the nature of a god, to be immortal and blessed. So they can't suffer any harm, and they can't have any motive to inflict suffering or feel any anger or take any injury. Second argument, happiness, it's the same thing if you're a god or if you're a mortal. It's the same condition. It consists in uninterrupted tranquility. That's a very Greek way of thinking. And all our early philosophers pretty much accept that that's really what happiness is all about. One of the measures of difference from us, I don't know if it would occur to you to think of uninterrupted tranquility as a definition or explanation of happiness, but that's the way they thought of it. So these gods enjoy an uninterrupted tranquility. If the gods were to intervene in human affairs in any way, it could only be from some disturbance of that tranquility, but that's impossible. The gods are immortal, they have no troubles, and they don't trouble others. And lastly, Epicurus says, the very fact that there's something flawed about our world, that there's such a thing as evil, that evil things happen to people, that fact ironically proves that the gods don't really care about us. Because the gods have the power to prevent any evil. If they don't do it, it must be because they just don't care. Despite that indifference, we can still benefit from the worship of the gods. Because by thinking about them, we formulate the right idea of happiness. Happiness is the same condition, whether you're divine or mortal. From the gods, we learn what I was just saying, that happiness is imperturbability, enduring tranquility. Not just being undisturbed, but being undisturbable. So that even if something unexpected happens, it doesn't throw you off, it doesn't destroy your tranquility. That, the Epicureans say, is happiness. Not money, not reputation, not even health, not even virtue, but only tranquility is the really durably satisfying thing, the elusive meaning of success in life. Now this philosophy of Epicurus, it is materialistic. There is in nature matter and empty space, and that's it. We are systems of matter. Our souls are systems of matter. Even the gods are systems of matter. Epicurus says that these gods have a human shape and that they are beautiful, but they do not have solid bodies. Think of a waterfall. Waterfalls exist. They are bodies. They have distinct shapes. You can recognize Niagara just by the profile. The matter of a waterfall, it's constantly changing, changing quickly, even violently, but the form, nevertheless, maintains constancy. A god is like that. Its body is composed of the finest particles that there are, and their constant flow creates the god's visible form without a solid body. The gods don't even live in the same world as us. They're not up there on Mount Olympus. They don't live in the same world with us or in any world. They live in the empty space between worlds, like the intergalactic space. That's where the gods live. That's where they enjoy their imperturbable serenity. So that's the first thing you need to know about happiness, is to have the right understanding of the gods. The second knowledge that we need for happiness is to understand death, and particularly to understand that it's not a harm, that it's nothing to fear. In that letter to Menoesius, Epicurus writes that death is nothing to us because everything that's good or bad depends on sense experience, and death is the end of sense experience. So it's impossible to call death good or bad. Now, that argument may seem a little too fast and clever. Maybe we can't logically call death bad, but we still fear it. A second argument attacks this fear from another direction. Epicurus says, death, the most frightening of bad things, is nothing to us, since when we exist, death is not yet present. And when death is present, we do not exist. So long as you exist, you're not dead. And once you're dead, you don't exist. So there's no you to be harmed by death. You can't hurt or harm something that doesn't exist. I want to speak next about Epicurus's atomism. This is a complicated overhead, but it's just for us, for our discussion here, and it's on the Avenue page, so you can take your copy from there. But this way you can have some points to follow my discussion. Remember Socrates. I told you that he told this story where he said to one of his friends, you know, when I was a young man, I was interested in that Ionian philosophy. Remember Anaximander, Xenophanes, Heraclitus? Very interested in that, Socrates said. I thought it would be great to be able to understand the arche, to know the causes of natural phenomena. But then he says, at a certain point, still when he was young, he decided, no, it's not for me, and he had to find a different way and take a different course in philosophy. So for Socrates, physics, or natural philosophy, was just a matter of indifference to him. For Epicurus, it's the opposite. Natural philosophy, physics, a theory about nature, is crucial to his philosophy. Enduring happiness depends on knowing the truth about nature. So why is this so important to him? It's because he believes that happiness requires having good explanations for natural phenomena, so that if there's an eclipse, or a storm, or a wind, an earthquake, none of those things should cause you to be fearful. You'll understand that they're just mechanical, mindless effects without any kind of purpose. The underlying philosophy of nature for this philosophy is atoms. The atomism of Democritus is the starting point for Epicurus, but he introduces several new features. And these are what I'm summarizing here. First idea, all bodies in nature, they're decomposable into small indivisible atoms or into molecular compounds. Second principle, nothing comes from nothing. Nothing completely disappears into nothing. The third, this cosmos, the whole universe, is bodies and void, and nothing else. Void is just the empty space in which atoms move, and the movement is endless. It's endless in a double sense. It's purposeless, it's without any goal, and it's also infinite. That is, it never stops. We call the philosophy of Epicurus materialism, but a void is nothing material. It's the single exception to his otherwise rigorous materialism. Void exists. It exists per se. It's as real as the atoms. And though it is immaterial, it is a cause. In fact, it's the ultimate cause of atomic motion. Why do atoms move? Because there's empty space and they fall into it. Fourth point, this universe is without any limit. It's without any limit in the extent of the void. It's without any limit in the number of atoms. And lastly, these atoms themselves, they have he says, his language is very careful here, they have inconceivably many different shapes. Inconceivably many, but not infinitely many. There's not an infinite variety of shapes. Democritus had made even the variety of shapes infinite. Epicurus says only that they're inconceivably many. The reason for this seemingly rather fussy qualification is just that atoms have to remain imperceptible. An atom is subvisible. But Epicurus thought that if shape really were infinitely various, then some atoms might be of any size. Some atoms could be as big as a tree. Another difference from Democritus is that Epicurus's atoms have parts. They have an internal structure. For Democritus, he said that those atoms are completely homogeneous, meaning that they have no internal parts. Aristotle refuted that argument. This is why Epicurus, coming after Aristotle, makes an adjustment to the theory of Democritus. Aristotle reasoned, he said, everything that moves is necessarily divisible. If something can move, it has to be divisible. Because imagine anything moving, it can be as small as you like, it's just got to be physically, you know, occupying space, have some dimension. If it has some dimension, then you can imagine a point, a geometrical point, and it will move past that point, some part of it will move past the point before the other part. So Aristotle says anything that moves has to be divisible. Epicurus accepts the argument. And in reply, he gives his atoms parts, minima, with extension, but minima that he says are inseparable from the atoms that constitute. So this is an idea of parts, but you can't take them apart. Every atom has an internal structure, but you can't rip it apart. And this idea of inseparable parts, it remains an element of particle theory right down to the present day, as in the way that quarks always come in threes. Epicurus's most notorious innovation is the theory of atomic swerve. Atoms are subject to an unpredictable swerve. The cosmos is not a rigid machine. It's more like a hurricane or a turbulent river. It's a system partly of chance, of chaos, and of genuine knowledge. Now, this involvement of chance, saying that there's something chance-like or stochastic about nature, this involvement of chance has always brought strong objections against Epicurean philosophy. Nature seems too orderly, too regular, and well-regulated to be the result of chance. The Roman Cicero spoke for many when he said, that hurly-burly, turbulent world of atoms will never produce the orderly beauty of our cosmos. And nevertheless, this idea of the swerve that Epicurus introduces is not some arbitrary or ad hoc hypothesis. He has very well-considered reasons for why he says that these atoms swerve in an unpredictable way. Imagine the cosmos as he thinks of it. Infinite empty space. Infinite atoms, and they just fall. That falling, it resembles a flowing fluid. I mean, that's really what fluids are too, when you think of them microscopically. So that falling, that flow of atoms, it's like the flow of a fluid. Now, one thing that's characteristic of all fluid motions, wherever you see them, is that they're subject to turbulence. Epicurus observes nature. Atoms are a stream, a current, like flowing water. If you see flowing water, if you stand over a bridge and look down at the river, especially look at how the river water flows around the piers of the bridge, or watch it anywhere, watch a creek, watch water in a drain or in a pipe. Anywhere that you see fluid motion, you watch it long enough and eventually you will see turbulence. And that's what that swerve is. It's turbulence in the stream of atoms. A turbulence that occurs in all moving fluids and renders their movement unpredictable and chaotic. The swerve is necessary for collision, and therefore necessary for the generation of compounds from these atoms, including all the visible bodies that make up the familiar world of our experience. These visible bodies are composites that reduce to atoms, but these visible bodies are not simply identical with the atoms. Composite structure brings new qualities into the world, new properties that solitary atoms don't have. Solitary atoms have no color, but composite bodies do. Solitary atoms have no texture, but composite bodies do. Democritus said that qualities like that, texture, color, he said those are merely human conventions. Epicurus disagrees with him on this point. For Epicurus, those qualities really belong to the compound bodies. They are emergent properties of atomic complexity. Next, a word about the soul. This is a materialist philosophy, but it doesn't deny that there's soul. It doesn't say soul is just a fiction. But it does deny the immateriality, the supposed immateriality of the soul. It denies the view of soul that we first emerged with Pythagoras, was developed in philosophy with Parmenides, and then became part of Plato's whole conception of philosophy. That Epicurus does deny. Soul is a body, it's a part of a human body, it's suffused throughout our organism, resembling a hot wind. This amorphous, wind-like body divides into mind and spirit. Mind is the power of deliberation, and it's concentrated in the heart. Spirit is dispersed throughout the whole body. The soul's composition is so delicate, its atoms are so small and volatile, that at death, the soul simply dissolves at once into its constituent atoms that then rejoin the universal flow. That was one of the reasons why death is nothing to fear. It's a matter of indifference. It's neither positive nor negative, pleasant nor painful, because with death comes the dissolution of the soul. There's no you, no enduring subject left to give meaning to values like pleasure and pain, good and bad. Epicurus is an early example in philosophy of an approach to knowledge that we still call empiricism. Remember that word empiria I talked about when we talked about Aristotle. Empiria is experience. Empiricism is the idea that knowledge is rooted in experience. It comes to us from experience. And that's Epicurus' teaching. The environment that we're familiar with, that we negotiate, and to which we're adapted, it's not just a fog of atoms and void. When we look out, that's not what we see. It contains enduring objects, compound bodies with emergent qualities like colors and textures, and new non-atomic shapes. Now, these compound bodies can be perceived. They can be made the objects of scientific knowledge. Perception is the foundation of that knowledge. That's what I mean by empiricism, rooting scientific knowledge in perceptions. Epicurus' teaching is that all perceptions are true. The trick is you just have to be very skillful at distinguishing between what you're actually perceiving and the opinions that crowd in quickly around anything that we perceive. But because all perceptions, pure perceptions, are true, that gives sensory observation a unique clarity and force of evidence. The senses respond immediately to the presence of things without any bias or presupposition. Our concepts in science inherit that evidence, provided that we secure a starting point for science in clear perceptions. From these, we form a first foundation of simple concepts, which become like the alphabet of scientific theory. We formulate with those simple concepts more elaborate concepts and make theoretical inferences. For this whole approach to knowledge to work, Epicurean philosophers have to be, as I was saying, very skillful at distinguishing between what you're actually perceiving and the associated opinions. They have to be able to discern what is truly perceived in a perception and what is just the trace of opinion or preconception. And that means, because you need that skill, that means training in logic is indispensable to scientific knowledge. But more importantly, logic actually becomes indispensable to the project of attaining happiness. Back to Socrates again. We can always go back to Socrates when I'm trying to get an orientation thinking about Western philosophy. Not all the philosophers say the same stuff. Epicurus is here changing, but he's a kind of a focus point where we can begin to remember what philosophy was supposed to all be about. There were two lines in Socrates. One was this idea of learning how to care for yourself, learning how to take care of your soul. For Socrates, happiness or virtue, these were problems of knowledge, and that's how philosophy could help you to care for yourself, care for your soul. So that's one line in Socrates. Another line in Socrates is idealism, the notion that being is idea, that fundamental reality is immaterial, spiritual, rational. For Plato, philosophy meant both of those things. It included both of those things. Plato condemns the poets and the sophists for their indifference to care for the self, and he condemns the materialists like Democritus for taking the soul out of nature, taking the immaterial forms and ideas out of nature. Well, Epicurus strongly accents the value of philosophy as care of the self. He very much agrees with Socrates on that point. But at the same time, he strongly denies idealism. He affirms materialism in the form of a renewed atomism. How is this Epicurean philosophy supposed to teach us to take care of ourselves? By teaching how to eliminate the sources of anxiety, which all lie in wrong ideas. Happiness is a problem of knowledge. The sources of unhappiness are wrong ideas about the gods, wrong ideas about death, wrong ideas about natural phenomena. Earthquakes and eclipses and lightning and so on, they're just mechanical effects of mindless atoms. They have no purpose, they have no meaning in our lives. It's childish to let them disturb your equanimity. Philosophy is just growing up. Another bit of useful knowledge after the atoms, another bit of useful knowledge is about desire. For Socrates, desire is innocent. It never leads us astray. Everything bad is due to insufficient knowledge. It's not because there's a problem with your desires, the problem is always in your knowledge. If you make your knowledge right, your desires will just fall unproblematically into place. That was Socrates' idea. But few after Socrates had that kind of confidence. Desire seems far from innocent. And it doesn't seem to be simple either. There are different kinds of desire, and they give rise to different problems. So Epicurus thinks that it's important for philosophy to be what he wants it to be, to help us to take care of ourselves, that it include a careful analysis of desire, which is what I summarized in this panel. He says you can split all desires into two great varieties. There are necessary desires and non-necessary desires. Necessary desires, what's necessary about them is that if you don't satisfy them, there's pain. They have to be satisfied unless there's pain. Non-necessary desires are ones that whose non-satisfaction doesn't automatically bring pain. and which can be satisfied by alternative methods. Among the necessary desires, Epicurus identifies a desire for happiness that includes a desire to practice philosophy, a desire to have friends, a desire for life and for the conditions of life, food, water, and a desire for an untroubled body, which makes us desire law for the protection of our body and our necessities of our body, and also makes you want to desire leisure so that you can enjoy a good life. Among the non-necessary desires, he identifies a class that are natural, that includes sex and the desire for immortality. These, he thinks, are the most dangerous of the desires. And also certain conventional desires, like the desire to have a good reputation. Now, the point of this analysis is to assist us in placing the right value on things. When we become conscious of a desire, then Epicurus' teaching is, before you just act on it, stop for a moment, be philosophical for a moment, examine yourself. What is this desire? Is it necessary or non-necessary? And if it's non-necessary, then what's the cost of indulgence? And is that a cost that you're willing to pay? Often you may be, and Epicurus will say, then good, great, go ahead. But just do so philosophically. This philosophy of Epicurus, I don't know if you knew anything about it before you started in this class. You've all heard, I suppose, the word Epicurean. He's an Epicurean. In contemporary language, that means something like a gourmet or a connoisseur. The word throughout Western history often was used in a very polemical way. This is something you may not be aware of because it's kind of dropped from our usage now. But for a long, long time, throughout all of the Middle Ages and on into the modern period, to call someone an Epicurean was kind of code, somewhat like the way we say now, oh, he's a terrorist. Epicurean, it was impossible to be good. Epicurean, that was code. That means atheist. That means materialist. That means someone who believes that there's nothing better than pleasure, might as well be a pig. This philosophy of Epicurus was notorious. Not that it was well understood, because after the close of the ancient world, nobody could read Epicurus anymore. They just have the memories. There was this guy, and they say such terrible things about him. This philosophy of Epicurus is notorious for several reasons. It's notorious for its materialism, for its denial of the spiritual element in nature. It's notorious for its involvement with chance and for arguing that there's no purpose or design in nature. It's notorious for indifference to death, making a mockery of the Christian promise of salvation. And it's most notorious for hedonism. Hedonism, from the Greek word for pleasure, hedonism is just the idea that pleasure is the highest good. There's nothing superior to pleasure. Now, we're going to want to ask, why does he take that view of pleasure as the highest good? But let me leave that aside for just a moment, and instead, let's think about what is pleasure. These handouts are all on the Avenue page, so everything there you can get later. We need to have the right idea about pleasure. And the first thing we need to understand, it's a mistake that people still make today, that pleasure is not a sensation. It's a feeling. In Greek, these are totally different words, just like they are in English. The pleasure of eating a food is not the sensation of the taste of the food in your mouth. It's rather a feeling that accompanies those sensations. It's the liking of those sensations and the liking of the food for causing those sensations. So that's one point you need to be clear about pleasure. Another is that this feeling of pleasure is also an evaluation of the sensations and of the object that those sensations respond to. sensations like that, like that sensation when you put some tasty morsel in your mouth, sensations like that and the objects that bring them, we can't help but like those sensations and want to repeat them and value them. And thirdly, pleasure is a distinct positive quality. Some philosophers define pleasure negatively, that it's just the absence of pain. It's nothing in itself, it's just not being in pain. That's not Epicurus's way of proceeding. Epicurus thinks that pleasure and pain are both positive qualities, that is, distinct qualities, opposite, mutually exclusive qualities, like the two poles of a battle. Now, everything that Epicurus has to say about pleasure, his whole teaching about hedonism, it won't make any sense at all, and it will be subject to very easy refutation, unless you follow him in making a little bit of a somewhat subtle distinction. It's the distinction that I've indicated here in two Greek words, between what he calls kinetic pleasures and katastematic pleasures. But really, kinetic, you understand, that means that has to do with movement, like kinetics. Katastematic, I don't even know, I've even asked specialists, how would you translate this? Nobody has any suggestion. It's a weird word of Greek. We don't need a translation, let's just stick with katastematic pleasure. The point is, what's the difference? It's a very important difference for Epicurus. Kinetic pleasure, that's the one you're familiar with. That's the pleasure in your mouth when you taste something tasty. These kinetic pleasures, they depend on their objects. It takes a certain object to cause you to have that pleasure. You have the tasty morsel, you have the delicious drink. Those kind of pleasures depend on their object. They're intermittent. You only get them, you know, occasionally when the object comes your way. They're discontinuous. The katastematic pleasures, by contrast, they are continuous rather than discontinuous, and they're independent of any external object. Now, as pleasures, they all feel the same. They all involve a felt, spontaneous, natural approval of your sensory state. Your life feels good. The difference is that kinetic pleasures are unsustainable. They're intermittent, and they may be difficult to obtain. And that means that kinetic pleasures are always going to be bound up with pain. This kind of pleasure, kinetic pleasure, it's shadowed by pain. It's always threatening pain. You know, any good taste becomes nauseating if you just have too much of it. And indeed, all these kinetic pleasures eventually convert into pain when there's excess. So Epicurus's rule is to always choose kinetic pleasures. He never says there's anything basically wrong with them. Always choose them unless there's a reason not to, but understanding that often there may well be such a reason. That's where the katastematic pleasures are different. There's never a reason not to prefer them. A katastematic pleasure is never the wrong choice. Katastematic pleasure is an unqualified good. Well, you're thinking, so what are these? He says there are basically two kinds, or two families of katastematic pleasures. The last 2 points from my handout, more unfamiliar Greek. Some of the katastematic pleasures fall into the family of what he calls aponia. That means the pleasure of leisure, of idleness, of physical ease, stressless well-being. And then there's the pleasure of what he calls ataraxia. That means the pleasure of an untroubled, tranquil mind. And now that we're a little more clear about just what this business of pleasure is, we can go back to the question that I mentioned that we need to raise about why hedonism. Why does Epicurus teach the teaching that there's nothing in the world better than pleasure? That pleasure is the highest good, the only inherent good. Well, that sounds like an excellent point on which for me to stop, to give you a reason to come back on Thursday. My assistants will come up to the front here, and you can turn over to them so that you're sure that it gets to the right place.